A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail?
Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Thanksgiving, well, it has come and gone. So it's time to talk réchauffé and avanci. That's leftovers in American. Let's get some ideas from LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold.
Even people who don't like the taste of turkey and think that it's inferior tend to love the flavor of turkey broth, which is actually stronger and more aromatic and so delicious. Plus, if you have a good turkey broth and lots of it, you can also make gumbo a couple days later. You can make Yucatecan sopa de lima, which is one of the most delicious possible soups in the world. It's basically just a reduced turkey broth. You fry some tortilla strips and sprinkle it over the top, and then you hand everybody halved lime to squirt into the soup. It is so delicious.
Are you an aficionado of the mashed potato sandwich?
Mashed potato sandwich?
There are some people that take all the leftovers and pile it between two pieces of bread. So it's not purely a mashed potato sandwich, but some people feel that the mashed potatoes fulfill the role of mayonnaise in this context.
I usually take the mashed potatoes and I'll grate a lot of Parmesan and sort of mix them up, then form them into croquettes and do flour, egg, panko crumbs and shallow fry them, and they're completely delicious. I'm very big on like another Sunday dinner of turkey bone gumbo. You brown the bones, you make a good, strong brown stock, you make as dark a roux as you can stand. Let it cook for a while. It's super delicious. I mean, the usual aromatics and stuff, too.
What do you do with leftover stuffing?
A, there never is leftover stuffing. But if there were leftover stuffing, it's really nice in an omelet. And it's also just take it, form it into a patty, and cook it in a little peanut oil so it, like, crisps up. It's so good.
It's really good.
The thing that I can never figure out is what do you do with leftover cranberry sauce, because there's always leftover cranberry sauce.
You turn it into a bar cookie if it's thick. I mean, that's what I always do. I make like a simple dough that I just press into the bottom of the pan, and then I re-thicken the cranberry sauce, or I'll add a little bit of thickener to it. I spread it on top, I add a crumble topping, and I bake it.
That sounds great, actually.
If we'd rather skip the leftovers, where should we go?
Delicious Food Corner.
Where is it located?
Monterey Park, but it's the part of Monterey Park you think you've sort of gone to Montebello, but you haven't yet. It's another block away.
Okay. Are we going there for a particular time of day, particular meal?
It's now open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but it is, I would say, the premier Hong Kong-style breakfast place in town.
And what does that mean?
That means porridge.
I'm sorry. I'm just imagining somebody from Santa Monica driving there for porridge.
Well, they should drive there for porridge. It doesn't have the glamour of dim sum. You're not sitting there. There aren't carts. There's already a super long line, especially at breakfast time on weekends. It's just doubled in size. And it's the most Hong Kong restaurant in LA, I would say. If you come at breakfast time, which is to say before, let's say, 11, there's a separate pretty cheap breakfast menu, which means you can get your choice of porridges, and then you get to choose your side dish. And the side dishes are fried noodles. You might ask, fried with what? Fried noodles. Those little egg noodles that are fried super crisp, but there's like a little bit of tangling in the center, and they taste like something that's been really well and cleanly fried. There are rice noodle rolls. There's a little bit of bean sauce, and there's a little bit of sesame sauce, and you can mix them or put some chili paste on or whatever you want to do with your rolls, but you get them. Or you could get them with a, sprinkling of dried shrimp.
Some protein.
That's your breakfast. If you are from Hong Kong or are in love with someone from Hong Kong, you will probably get, what do you even call them? They're pineapple buns or Hong Kong style buns, which means that they're glazed. They have like a little bit of like egg wash and sugar thing on top. They're split open and a really large amount of butter is sort of stuck inside to melt or really not to melt.
So it's like a buttery split donut-y thing.
Well, it's like sort of a bao or like a pineapple bun, except instead of having pork in it, there's some butter.
Okay. Oh, I like that description. Now, does one order that along with porridge or instead of?
Oh, you order that with porridge.
Okay.
And not everybody has to order porridge here. I mean, the bowls of porridge are large, and probably the newbie mistake, and the mistake that I make every time I go there because I want to taste as many kinds of porridge as I can, is you order a bowl of porridge for every person. But in fact, that's an excessive amount of porridge. You want to like order a bowl of porridge for every two or three people, and then you want some noodles and those rolls and maybe yuqiao, which are those Chinese crullers or fried flour sticks, whatever they call them, that you dip into the congee and your life is happy. Or you can get yuqiao and like pour condensed milk on it from the pitcher that's supposed to go with Hong Kong style tea, but maybe nobody's watching.
If I ate this breakfast,
yes,
I would need a cot nearby so I could take a nap.
Maybe. I mean, it's not, I'd imagine it's not super high in fat, but it's very high in carbs. You can get seven different kinds of carbs. One of the best things there is the rice noodle roll wrapped around the donut. So you get carb on carb, and then you dip that into your rice porridge, and that's carb on carb on carb. And I don't know, you could do it infinitely.
Carb to the fourth.
So many carbs. So many glorious, wonderful carbs.
It sounds so good. So there's nothing salty on the table. There's not going to be any, like, any green, gratuitous green for health or a lonely egg.
Well, people will get eggs. You can get, like, noodles with eggs on them. And, of course, the congee itself isn't sweet. It's rice that's boiled. It's very thick and smooth. My favorite, which they're always out of, is the one with pork and, like, salted mustard greens.
Okay, that makes all the difference to me now that you've told me that.
I think probably the most popular one is the pork with like thousand-year egg in the center. You can get it with cubes of pork blood. You can get the chicken one, which is actually really nice. Specify chicken on the bone rather than chicken off the bone.
Why?
There's just more flavor to it. I don't know why.
Aren't they just taking the same meat off the bone?
I think off the bone is probably like chicken breast. And don't quote me on that, even though I'm saying it on the radio. And the other one is like dark meat, which is, of course, the king of all chickens, as we know.
Yes.
By the way, speaking of chickens, if you order as a side dish a plate of chicken wings fried with spicy salt, you will not be sad.
I can't believe you waited till the end to tell me that.
Well, you want to eat it with the porridge, but not dip it in the porridge.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Delicious Food Corner in Monterey Park. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Next, we hear from the guy behind some great David Bowie and Prince covers recorded in kitchens and restaurants around town. That's after a short break. Don't go anywhere.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
Small Jean Gina, snuck off to the city, strung out old lasers and slashed back blazers.
That's blues singer-songwriter Reverend Sean Amos. He's covering David Bowie's Gene Genie for his weekly YouTube series, Kitchen Table Blues. These days, the blues seem more relevant than ever. Hi.
Hi.
You're a native Angeleno, as am I, and I'm curious about your childhood. I know your dad.
You know him personally?
No, but I know your dad, Famous Amos.
Yep.
And his cookies had a prominent spot in the middle of Hollywood. Was that sort of your locus, one of your centers when you were a kid growing up?
That was the epicenter of my childhood. Yeah, he had a store in Sunset Formosa. It's now Bossa Nova Restaurant. It was. He moved in after it was a House of Pies. Remember House of Pies?
Yeah, I mean, you can never take away that architecture.
Yeah, the A-frame store. And it was literally my childhood home. I had a little clubhouse in the back parking lot, and I sort of hung out in the storage room with all the big bags of flour. I had birthday parties there in the kitchen. When the store first opened, I was the only staff. So he worked in the back and made the cookies. I stood on milk crates in the front, worked the cash register, and it was literally my first job. And so, yeah, it was an interesting time there. Yeah, it was sort of this kind of seedy. Hollywood's pretty seedy back then.
And I understand that your childhood was sort of the opposite of helicopter parenting. It was kind of free range, right?
Yeah, I was sort of the quintessential latchkey kid. You know, my father was off and doing his thing. My parents were divorced. My mother was pretty mentally ill and was not capable a lot of times of really mothering me. So I hung out home a lot and had free run of Hollywood. And I ran around the streets of Hollywood a lot.
Was part of that experience having pocket money to feed yourself?
I had this weird relationship with food growing up. Yeah, because I was a latchkey kid, my diet was hamburger helper and TV dinners. It was not a foodie household at all. And my father made these amazing cookies. And it was all he could make other than French toast and pancakes. And so I ate, there's a Kentucky Fried Chicken. It was all these like crazy fast food weirdo places along that Sunset Strip. And I ate at all of them. There's a liquor store that's still there. That's two blocks down the street. And I would get Hostess pies. My dad runs a cookie store, and I'm getting Hostess pies. And I'd wash it down with chocolate chip cookies. And there's a Tiny Nailers. I don't know if you remember Tiny Nailers.
Oh, of course.
And sometimes we'd go there for dinner. There's a drive-through restaurant thing. And so it was lots of junk food. I did not eat healthy as a kid.
Your YouTube series is so interesting because each week you're in a different place, a different food-centered
place.
Yeah,
starting to now.
When did food sort of become a different kind of center for you?
Partly being a parent, partly owning a house and having a kitchen. I wanted to, do something with it. The entry point for me was farmers markets. There was a moment about 8 years ago where I realized what I was eating was really horrible. And I wanted something that had flavor again. And I wanted to know where things came from. And I wanted to introduce my children to people who actually grew the food that we ate. And I discovered this amazing farmers market in Studio City. And it just became my second home. I've gone there every Sunday for 9 years. And I know everyone there. And it is a big part of my life. And out of that, I was buying mainly just stuff to nosh on. So having raw food on the table for my kids to eat and as opposed to junk food. And then I realized I was seeing things at the farmer's market that I wanted to learn what to do with. And I didn't know what to do with it. So I just started looking at recipes on YouTube and online. I started listening to your show. And every Sunday when I came home from the farmer's market, I would just challenge myself to make something. And I realized it was like music, really therapeutic. And it really allowed my brain to focus and block out all the other stuff going on in my life. It's really meditative in a way that I needed and still need. And so I started really enjoying cooking and enjoying the presentation of cooking and having people. And it sort of grew into this thing where every Sunday I'd just invite people over. So I was experimenting on them. And I figured that's how Kitchen Table Blues was born, literally by just inviting people over to make some concoction I thought of making. And then, let's play some music together and hang out.
That was going to be my question, this sort of bringing together food and the blues in a very purposeful way.
I'm frustrated by the relationship between not just food and music, but between sort of like music and food in public places. Sometimes the music's annoying for people and they want it to be background music. And sometimes the music's so much of the show that people forget about the food. And it just feels like there's like this sort of uneasy alliance. So I'm trying to figure out how to resolve that. And Kitchen Table Blues is part of that for me. For people to think about music curation the same way they think about how they curate a menu. And that's sort of what this thing's about.
When did you go from being Sean Amos, producer, record executive, to becoming the Reverend?
Italy. I was in Italy in 2012. An old bandmate of mine is now in the wine business, Prosecco. And his name's Jeremy Parson. He's got a great blog, actually, Dobianchi. And he, one of his clients in Italy is a blues lover, a very wealthy man in northern Italy, and he wanted to hear blues at his castle. And he asked Jeremy, couldn't you put together a blues band for me? So we went to Italy. We did these gigs in this guy's castle in northern Italy up in a place called Cisone di Valmarino. It's about a 45-minute drive north of Venice in the Dolomites. And during the performances, the crowd were calling me the reverend. You are like a reverend. You are like a reverend. And there was something that happened to me as a performer being there in front of those people where I became very much in touch with my past and my heritage and my race in sort of a way that I'd been, I think, frankly, a little bit embarrassed about before and sort of unsettled about. And so I just sort of became this different performer, and they called me a reverend as a compliment. And so I came back the reverend.
What a great story. So Kitchen Table Blues, your album, features original compositions and old standards. And you also cover Christina Aguilera's Beautiful at Mr. C in Beverly Hills and Prince's Let's Go Crazy outside a coffee stand in Studio City. How do you decide what to sing each week and where to sing it?
The challenge for me is this has gone on, and we've done 70 of these now and never repeated a song. And so the challenge that goes on is to maintain spontaneity and not to get too inside about it. So not too much is thought out about it. But, you know, we started mining the great blues catalogs and Muddy Waters songs and Howlin' Wolf songs and Willie Dixon songs and on and on. And at a certain point, I realized that there are a lot of songs that are essentially blues songs that are disguised as being something else. The Gene Genie track is a Howlin' Wolf song. And so it became interesting for me to figure out where are the blues underpinnings of these songs and how can I strip away everything else from it and just get it as elemental as possible. And it's not unlike the food thing I'm into right now, which is, you know, how do you just strip away artifice and how do you just strip away everything that doesn't really add value and create something that is just, well, there's no interference, you know, between you and what you want to hear or you and what you want to taste or you what you want to get across as an emotion. And so, and I guess the last piece of it is, it's fun to play gritty music in upscale environments. I love that irony. And I like being in a place like Mr. C, which is this, you know, Cipriani-owned place and has a big legacy of luxury and opulence in some degree and playing this gritty Delta blues thing. I like, it's like the sweet and savory kind of thing. I dig that.
And I understand that cooking at brunch is a ritual for the Kitchen Table Blues crew.
Yeah, everyone's got it. It's potluck. I mean, everyone shows up. The day starts for me early. I go to the farmer's market in the morning, and I pick up a bunch of stuff. I have some folks come over on 10 and start preparing some of the longer lead stuff. My daughter loves to cook, and so she's my sous chef. And then another wave of people coming around 11, and folks have their assignments about what to bring. So there's a little bit of a potluck element. By 12 or 1, we're ready to actually play some music.
And what are some of the favored menu items?
I always have to have something sweet because my kids, I have 3 kids, a 15-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 7-year-old. So it's got to be French toast in some formation. There's got to be pancakes. And then on the adult side of it, frittatas, egg dishes, salads. I made your gazpacho. You had a show a little while ago, and I made the watermelon gazpacho, which is amazing and huge hit. So it's pretty traditional with sort of one or two things that may be a little bit outside.
Do you ever make your dad's chocolate chip cookies?
No. Short answer. I grew up at a cookie store, but I'm a total donut fanatic.
What's your favorite donut in town?
Oh, man.
I know it's hard.
Yeah.
You don't want to alienate people.
Yeah.
But just give a shout out to a donut
place.
I
still like Bob's, man.
Me too. You Bob's know? Is my favorite.
Old school. I'm still
old
school.
I love that.
People got to remember the old school.
Yeah. Being an Angeleno, mm-hmm. What is sort of the most fundamental change that you feel in the city over the last 40 years?
Oh, wow. Oh, well, it's a lot more crowded. That's number one. Yeah, I got to say, it's less segregated. And there's a great, I keep plugging your own shows, but there was that great, the Green Book show you did with Candace, which is amazing. And it brought up a lot of memories of me growing up here in LA when it was a segregated town. I wasn't the only black kid in my school until I was in ninth grade. It's a much more integrated city now. And maybe that's because I can get around easier now than I could back then, but I do think it's more mixed. I also think that it's, it kind of was a joke, like, there's no culture in LA, and it was sort of that cheap way out to sort of demean Los Angeles compared to New York or other cities. And I think it's a presumption and an understanding that there is really deep, wonderful, unique culture in Los Angeles. And people sort of laugh when they hear culture in Los Angeles in the same sentence.
Reverend Sean Amos is the host of Kitchen Table Blues. We go out on his version of When the Saints Go Marching In, featuring Missy Anderson. Take him to church. In a minute, we hear the fond memories that one chef has of his mother's artful spring rolls and the mouthfuls of mousse made by an early mentor. Don't turn that dial.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
I love sweets, and Jack was making tart tatin. My grandmother was making another kind of apple tart. Every day I would be able to eat actually an entire pie or entire tart after school and before dinner. And I had no problem to have many, many other sweets during the day, including chocolate mousse again.
That's Eric Repair. Long before he earned his third Michelin star for his New York institution, Le Bernardin, Eric was just a lanky youth from a broken home looking for solace. With resilience and a sweet tooth, he gravitated towards the kitchen. In his new book, 32 Yolks, Eric shares memories of his mother's artful spring rolls, mouthfuls of mousse from an early mentor, and the blistering tongue of one of the world's greatest chefs. Hi, Chef. I'm so happy to be speaking with you again.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to talk to you as well and to discuss the book, of course.
You write that your grandmother taught you how food brings people together and how it has the power to make even the loneliest person feel like the center of the universe. Did other women in your life also encourage your interest in food?
Oh, definitely. I mean, not only my grandmother. My aunts, when it was the summertime, were gathering the entire family around food, and we were having those very long lunch and very long dinners. The kids were allowed to leave the table anytime they wanted and come back, and the family was still eating. My mother was a great cook, and she always made sure that my meals were memorable. And I think everybody who knows me well has done that in the past and still do that.
When was it that your interest in food changed from just being a kid who just loved to eat to a time when you actually entered a kitchen?
I love eating, and nobody ever let me go to the kitchen and prepare the food. But when I went to culinary school, I was about 15 years old. Finally, I was in contact with ingredients and the real process of cooking. I was not necessarily totally excited about learning the basics. But when I started in Paris at 17 years old in La Tour d'Argent, suddenly I was exposed to fine dining and to amazing ingredients. It's where I really, really knew that I had a passion for cooking and craftsmanship.
You lost your father at quite a young age. You were 11, and you were befriended by a local chef who was sort of like the chef terrible. Could you tell us a bit about him, about Jacques?
Sure. So Jacques was retired legionnaire who did many wars, one of them being Vietnam. And then he ended up in Andorra and opened a small restaurant, maybe 20 covers. He was by himself in the kitchen. His wife was in the dining room. And every day he would create a menu. And it was no other option than what he was cooking for you. And really, Jacques was very famous character in the mountains of Andorra, where I lived, because he would basically choose you. You wouldn't choose to go chez Jacques. He would have clients coming, and then he would throw them out of the restaurant, screaming at them, and they would have no idea why. And then some people passing by would be welcome with a big smile and great honors. So he was very funny, and people thought he was a bit crazy, but he was really playing. He liked to be extravagant. His cooking was delicious. He was the best restaurant in the country. It's a small country. It's only 50,000 people living in Andorra. However, Jacques was the celebrity of the town and the country.
Tell us about him and the mousse.
Jacques was the king of the chocolate mousse. It's funny because for many, many years, we're talking about probably more than 20 years, he used the same bowl to mix the ingredients and the same fork to beat the egg whites that he was putting into, he didn't even use a whisk, and that he was putting in his chocolate mousse. I love that chocolate mousse so much that every day after school, instead of studying, I will observe Jacques in the kitchen, and I knew more or less what time he will make his chocolate mousse, and he will always, always give me many bowls of the mousse.
What was it like living in Andorra at that time?
Andorra was, and still is, a small country. It's 30 miles by 40 miles. It's basically living in a big village where everyone knows everyone. It's two schools. One is the Spanish school. The other one is the French school. It's very, very rustic. It's in the middle of the mountains. And at the time, we were open to France and Spain, of course, but we didn't have that many ingredients that were not seasonal and coming from Andorra at the time. So Jacques was going to the markets, he was going to see the farmers, and he was going to see the butchers and so on, and deciding on his menu. So was my mother as well, because she was an excellent cook, and she will do that too.
When you started your culinary career, did that happen in Paris?
My culinary career started a little bit before Paris. I did a training during a summer in between the 2 years of culinary program. But then, seriously, working was in Paris, in La Tour d'Argent. In 1982, they were celebrating their 400 years old anniversary. And it was really, really, for me, a very difficult, but at the same time, a fantastic experience.
In the book, you say that instinct in the kitchen develops very, very slowly. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't think anyone is born with all the knowledge that is required in cooking. Knife skills, you need to train. And it's hours of training and hours of precision that makes you master the skills. When you make a sauce, to catch the flavors in your sauce and to be able to reproduce the same sauce with the same flavors and the same balance and harmony for everyone require a lot of techniques and years of craftsmanship. And therefore, it takes years and years to become a good cook and to become a chef. You're not born with the qualities of a chef, that's for sure.
And lots of correction.
Yes, lots of corrections because you make mistakes. It's almost like physics when you cook. I mean, the egg yolks at a certain temperature, if they are not emulsified properly, will coagulate. And therefore, instead of having a nice sabayon to make an hollandaise, you will have an omelette or scrambled eggs. Again, you have to practice. You have to be challenged. Sometimes make the mistake. And then you remember, and the next time you don't make the same mistake, and you evolve like that.
Do you think that having this kind of patience over a very long arc of time is a challenge for the young cooks you see today?
I don't think so. As we know today, the food world is divided in two. You have television cooking, and then you have the real cooking in restaurants. And it's a big difference. And as much as television is fantasy and potentially could be dangerous, giving the wrong idea to young people about what is cooking, we see more and more young cooks coming to our kitchens who know the difference and know that they are going to be sacrificing a lot of time to become good cooks. And they're very ambitious. They want to have good restaurants, and they are willing to spend years and years of apprenticeship learning before they become chefs and be able to create their vision.
When you graduated from school, you had to have 120 dishes committed to memory.
Mm-hmm.
And one would think that Hollandaise sauce would be easy for you, but you titled your book 32 Yolks. I have a suspicion that it was the 32 yolk Hollandaise that sort of brought you to your knees.
Absolutely. I was 17 years old. On my first morning in La Tour d'Argent, the chef said, make me a Hollandaise with 32 yolks. The mass of the yolks together has to be whisked. And it's very challenging because it's heavy. the stove is very hot. I didn't have the strength and I didn't have the habit of being so close to the heat. And basically, I was not able to make a sabayon and finish my Hollandaise. I basically scrambled the eggs in a bowl, in a pot, and it was a disaster. It took me weeks and months to master those 32 yolks and make a beautiful Hollandaise. Basically, the title of the book represents this pivotal moment in my career where from a beginner cook, I become a real cook who knows the craftsmanship in the kitchen.
How did you come to cook in the kitchen of the great chef Joël Robuchon?
After a year and a half in La Tour d'Argent, I was young, I was 18 and a half. I really wanted to try the style of other chefs, to learn something different. The chef of La Tour d'Argent basically introduced me to Chef Robuchon. And it's the way we were doing at the time. And even today, a lot of the young cooks come to see their chef and say, you know, I would like to work for another chef, can you recommend me? And we do that, it's a tradition of the industry. So therefore, I was introduced to Chef Robuchon, who hired me. And a few months later, I was starting in the kitchen of the famous Jamin in Paris.
And what was your first station? And what was the experience like working for him compared to being in Tour d'Argent?
Joël Robuchon had a small restaurant, 40 seats, 25 cooks, very tiny kitchen, not too much space for the cooks to evolve, but we were ultra-efficient. From a very vibrant kitchen, I discovered a very zen kitchen, very peaceful kitchen, where you could hear only the voice of Joël Robuchon himself. After he would order the food, all the other cooks would say, yes, chef. And that was a big cultural difference for me. But then I realized that the cooks were very scared of him and very scared of his demands. Although he was not a violent chef, Joël Robuchon was not a screamer either, but he was extremely demanding for himself and for his cooks. His demands were almost irrational sometimes, and it was very difficult to achieve his vision. When he was frustrated, we would be frustrated with him, and we would feel his pain, and it became a very stressful experience. However, an amazing experience, of course, because if I am where I am today, it's because of him.
One of the things in the book that I found so fascinating was not just the culinary arc, the arc of your profession and gaining skill, but also your personal emotional arc from being a young boy who had a lot of loss and a lot of experiences of not fitting in and being kind of rebellious and angry, to a chef who has a great deal of discipline and a very developed sense of sort of inner peace and calm.
Well, that comes with experience, of course. But I have to say, I mean, to me, when I came to America in 1989, I discovered something that became very important in my life. I discovered Buddhism. It changed completely my way, slowly but surely, changed completely my way of seeing life, having a level of contentment, and the way I interact with people. It has been very important. However, I do not try to convert the team to my beliefs. I apply secular ways of sharing the wisdom and making sure that we have a kitchen that is peaceful, and I want to have motivated cooks that are definitely not scared, neither abused. And it's a constant work and struggle because we work under pressure, but we succeed pretty well, and it makes me very happy.
At Le Bernardin, you're known for your fish and seafood. And when you ended your time with Robuchon, you were the head of the fish station. You've said cooking meat brings the soul out of you, but fish brings elegance out of you. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yes. You need to be trained on both aspects. Cooking meat is very different than cooking fish. For instance, if you do a stew, if you cook your meat 5 minutes longer than what you expected, it's not going to have an effect on your dish. Now, when you cook fish, you have to be a very good technician. Fish by nature is very fragile, very delicate, and therefore it requires a lot of techniques to handle the fish by itself. And then when you cook it, you have to be, again, extremely precise, because 30 seconds could destroy the qualities of the fish by overcooking it instead of having something juicy and moist and flavorful, you will have a piece of fish that is basically tasting like cardboard.
Would you share with me a moment in the kitchen in your history that was kind of the single most terrifying moment?
I had many, many moments that were intense. One of them could have been maybe in La Tour d'Argent where I went to have my dinner and I forgot 24 ducks in oven that were already cooking for quite some time. When I came back from dinner, the kitchen was basically a dark cloud. And when we opened the ovens, everything was in flames and the ducks became pieces of charcoal. Then I had to explain to the chef my mistake. And that was kind of terrifying, I would say.
Really terrifying.
Yes.
Because that's time and money.
Yes.
Gone. What about the most satisfying moment?
I mean, at that time, when I was not the chef de cuisine that I am today, when I could reproduce the dish that the chef was asking me to create for him, it was really a great sense of accomplishment. Today, when I can have the team reproducing my vision, I feel really good. I'm very happy that we have been able to share the knowledge and the cooking wisdom with the team, and they are cooking exactly the same way that I would cook myself for the client.
It's so complicated to do.
Well, it is. Yeah, it takes time. But at the same time, it's the beauty of sharing knowledge. And it's very particular to my industry. We share knowledge every day, and it takes a long time, and it creates a relationship in between the mentor and the student.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It was my great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Eric Ripert's new memoir is 32 Yolks, From My Mother's Table to Working the Line. Up next, we learn about a cookbook author you may not have heard of. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I don't know about you, but I'm always fascinated to hear how people find their chosen work. When I was in a room listening to journalist Donna Battle Pierce talk about a female cookbook author I'd never heard of, named Frida DeKnight, I had to learn more. I asked Donna to join us to shed some light on Frida, whom she calls one of her heroes. So who was Frida DeKnight?
Frida DeKnight was an amazing woman. She was a Black woman who was the daughter of a Pullman porter. And her father was a Pullman porter. Her mother was a traveling nurse. And she was actually born on a train. Her father passed away when she was 2 years old. And her mother continued to be a traveling nurse and moved her to South Dakota to family friends. And the mother would come and go. But she lived with the Scott family, who were caterers. And that was not uncommon all over during the period after the Civil War, as Blacks moved north and west. And it was not uncommon to have fabulous caterers and to go and to do wonderful hotel food and picnic food and reunion food and dinners for churches. And she fell in love with all things culinary by working with the family.
The family that she grew up with, the Scotts, did they cater for white families or for other African-American families?
For white families. They farmed and catered and made these amazing dishes.
Just to put this in a time perspective, we should say that Frida was born in 1909.
Born in 1909.
And what is her seminal work?
She was such an amazing woman, but she wrote a cookbook that was, to me, an amazing cookbook called The Date with the Dish. And she wrote the book in 1948. I actually went and spent 2 weeks researching the places she had been and going back to find some of the things that might be left behind. She was in South Dakota. She spent time in Omaha. She spent time all around the Midwest, in Missouri, and then moved to Harlem and then came to Chicago, where she became the first food editor for Ebony magazine. But she also was the person who founded the Ebony Fashion Fair.
This book, Date with a Dish, is fascinating to me because as soon as I heard you speak, I, of course, ran home and went to try and buy a first edition. And I actually had it for 3 seconds before somebody swooped in and took it away from me.
Wow. Yeah, they're hard to get.
And I understand that the subsequent editions of the book, which were brought out by Ebony, were a bit different. Tell us about the book and why it has such a huge importance.
Right, right. And in fact, when we were together at the IACP conference, the book was chosen this year as one of the classic cookbooks printed after 1946. And it happened to be that it was the book that Frida did as an African-American food editor. But the 1948 edition, A Date with a Dish, 400 pages filled with recipes. And as I learned as a food journalist, because even food journalism, it used to be that there were home ec teachers that were contributing to newspapers and magazines. And then it became journalists, really not until the end of the 90s, that journalists were moving into that role in newspapers. And it's one that I did at the Columbia Tribune and then the Chicago Tribune. There's a style to your recipe, and it's a style that readers are usually not aware of. You always mention the same way how a cup is done and in the order of when ingredients are used and how you stir. Those, it's a certain style, as in any kind of journalism. And she adopted that style as opposed to a folksy or whatever style. It's a very journalistic style of food writing.
Could you describe the type of food that is represented so our listeners get an idea?
Sure. I have my my mother's copy open on my lap, and I'm on page 208 of the 1948 edition, and I'm looking at Ebony's all-in-one dish that's made with leftover lamb and pork and chicken and fresh parsley. Then there's a lamb casserole made with lamb shoulder. Then there is arroz con pollo, rice and chicken, Spanish style, she calls it, with a long grain rice and fresh parsley and rosemary. And then there is a rice and frankfurter casserole. And I remember later in the book, she mentions, because she also had a monthly column that appeared in Ebony. And she mentioned Louis Armstrong, who would say, you know, who loved red beans and rice. But he said, oh, you don't have to cook with expensive things. You know, I love my red beans. I think she's one of the first to mention that he signed his letters, Red Beans and Ricely Yours.
Yes, so we should say that the recipes are a breadth of dishes from cultures all over the world.
Oh, she had this amazing chapter called Collector's Corner. And in that chapter, she had gone and interviewed and had cooked with and spoken with very affluent and very prominent Black families around the country and included their names and a little bit of their narrative, a little of their story, and then their recipe. And so in this one chapter are these family recipes representing, you know, every region in the United States and bringing that to light.
Could you share with us one of your favorites from Collector's Corner?
Sure. She's in Louisiana and she has about 5 or 6 different regional recipes of the Gulf Coast of gumbo. And this is the one place where I went and found the most similar recipe to my family's recipe, which you never see those kinds of things published. She has a banana bread that is absolutely my favorite. I had grown up eating banana bread. And you know how now we have really sweet breads, and it's delicious, wonderful banana bread that you get. I'm testing all of the recipes that are in the book and reproducing them, and I just did this on one particular day, and it was amazing. It only had 1/4 of a cup of sugar, And all of a sudden, I was about 7 years old, and I remembered my grandmother's banana bread. And that's what banana bread used to taste like before it sort of evolved into what we think of as very sweet, which is also delicious. But this original one was served at ladies' teas and spread with cream cheese. And everybody I bring that to has a memory. Everybody of, you know, from my time. All the boomers that I know will say, oh, my goodness, this is just like my mom used to make or my grandmother used to make. And if you think back to that time before school integration, this sort of plantation-style cookbooks where you'll see somebody, a mammy person standing with a bandana, you'll see this was a very sophisticated, intelligent woman. She traveled all over the country. She met with white and black food editors. And she met with black cooks who lived all over the country. And she reproduced recipes that were more than just what we were calling from the 60s soul food. She reproduced all kinds of different recipes that had been perfected by black family cooks.
She, in fact, turned her back on that mammy plantation stereotype.
Not only did she turn her back, and what's funny, even now, so much of the black middle class has never really been appreciated in the sense that in every city in this country, there was a tremendous black middle class. I have a family collection of photographs of beautifully dressed and different club groups and whatever from the 20s and 30s and 40s. And she found that in every city. And she went and applauded that, spoke with them, and everyone so appreciated that she was bringing this to the forefront.
Is this book by Frida DeKnight, Date with a Dish, is this a book that is found in basically every African-American home?
Of a certain generation. This book was the only cookbook that my grandmother had in her kitchen. And of all of her peers and friends and whatever, that they respected as a cookbook, that most of the time they were family recipes people used or recipes that were written down. But this was a book that every single club woman, they were called themselves, and sorority women, college-educated black women, everybody I know had this cookbook.
So was part of this book aspirational?
I think it was more that it was at last a reflection of a life that we didn't see anywhere else. And I think that most people who had it were living the life, and they were just able then to see this documented, and they were cheering Frida DeKnight on because she was doing this.
Because finally there was something that reflected their actual experience.
Exactly. That wasn't the person in the kitchen saying, even like the woman, you know, from Popeye's Chicken now, who's on saying, you know, we love this. Here was an educated, lovely, well-dressed woman who traveled to Europe every year, who was a club woman, who wrote these wonderful cookbooks.
One of the things that I find so interesting, too, is who she calls the little brown chef, this illustration that is used throughout the book to bring us into the recipes.
My cousin was the art director for Ebony, Herbert Temple. And he is the person who created the Little Brown Chef. As opposed to being a buffoon or all of, you know, the common characters that you see, here is a charming person who is a little logo to show that here is a chef who is a brown chef cooking for brown people. And not a brown chef that's cooking for the white country club or for white families, but a brown chef who's there encouraging brown ladies. And she often talked about that, that this was a cookbook written by a black woman for other black families.
How old were you when you discovered her work?
Probably cooking for the first time in the 70s. And I was going through cookbooks and found this, and my mom started talking about her. And so I started to look through the recipes and really didn't think that much of it. When I learned, too, that she had been fashion background, and I was trying to talk my parents into, I was explaining to them that I wanted to write about food and fashion, and that wasn't the thing for a young black woman to write about back then. Everybody was saying, well, food is something we're going to go past, and why don't you do something a little more interesting or a little bit more academic? And I used her as my person, my icon, and that was the reason that I stuck to it, that I wanted to write about this amazing food that hadn't really been talked about in this amazing history of the cooks who didn't really want to be famous, who wanted to be family cooks, but who had created these amazing family recipes that all of us enjoyed and shared.
That's food writer Donna Battle Pierce. You can find a link to her recent work and learn more about Frida Denight on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. We close out the show with a guest DJ set. This one features Emeril Lagasse on the turntables with KCRW's own Eric J. Lawrence. Take it away, Eric.
Hi, I'm Eric J. Lawrence, and I am here with Emeril Lagasse, one of the most recognizable chefs in the world, and currently stars in the globetrotting Amazon series, Eat the World. But today, we're here to talk about five songs that have inspired him throughout his life. Chef Lagasse, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Eric, so much for having us and being here. This is really quite exciting.
Great. Well, what's the first track you got for us?
Piano Man by Billy Joel. The interesting story is that there's a character in one of the lyrics of this song.
Now John at the bar is a friend of mine.
And John used to work for me at Commander's Palace. Way before he was with Billy Joel. But what's amazing about the song is that it's, for me, it's very deep. It's very personal. There's a lot in there that says a lot about people and places and just things going on in life then and things that are going on in life now. So one of my favorite songs.
You mentioned being familiar with the character from the song. What is the relationship of music in New Orleans?
Well, you know, that's probably one of the components why I've stayed and lived there for so long, because not only is it one of the greatest food cities in the world, in my opinion, but the architecture, the spirit of being European, but then again, when it really comes down to it, the music is really serious in New Orleans. And it's not only jazz either. So it makes it a happy place. It makes me happy.
And the waitress is practicing politics as the businessmen slowly get stoned. Yes, they're sharing a drink they call loneliness, but it's better than drinking alone.
That was Billy Joel with Piano Man. So what's the next track you got for us?
Well, I'm a huge U2 fan. I can't believe what four human beings, the sound that these guys can create. And I've had the pleasure of meeting most of them, and it's a song called Vertigo. Vertigo was a song that I used to listen to in the car in New York all the time, going to and from. It was just one of those songs that moved me, put me in a good mood, whether it was night or day. But just hearing the collaboration of those four guys and you two, it's amazing, amazing music.
That was U2 with Vertigo, as selected by our guest, Emeril Lagasse. Up next, I see you have something from country singer Zac Brown.
I just had the pleasure of recently being in Zac and his band's company, a very small performance that was done for a very special cause. And also, I'm a fisherman, so I'm out on the boat a lot when I can be, and tune into Zac Brown's greatest hits right now is like really special. But there's just something that when this song Free comes on that just sort of makes me think that we all at times feel like we're hostages of something. And so Zac Brown Free is definitely for me.
just as free.
I think it was sort of a really unique decision when you did Emerald Live to have a live band in the studio.
Well, I felt that, you know, Jay Leno had one and David Letterman had one, you know, with Paul. And so when we were talking about creating Emerald Live, we were like, it first started out with very small one or two musicians. And then all of a sudden it was like, we need an Emerald Live band, you know. And I was very blessed to find and work with Doc Gibbs. And we had an amazing journey. You know, everybody that was into food that played music wanted to come on the show because they knew they were going to eat well, for sure, you know. And it was really a good, really good run.
Just as free. Free as we'll ever be. Just as free. Will ever be and ever be.
That was the Zach Brown Band with Free, as selected by our guest, Chef Emeril. Well, what's the next song you got for us?
Right Now by Van Halen. I love the Halen brothers, but I love when Sammy Hagar did the song and how he does the song, and he still does it. Sammy, over the years, has become a really good friend of mine. An incredible father and family guy and musician. And, you know, he's a great cook, you know, on top of that. He really is a really good cook and knows quite a bit about food and is so passionate about food. So when we're together, it's food and music and family, and we have a lot of fun.
Does he have a specialty?
You know, he's of Italian background, but having the influences of the water, the beach, Cabo Wabo, those influences, he loves those specialty tacos and fillings, and he likes to eat. He eats very healthy. He eats very light.
That was Van Halen with Right Now, featuring Sammy Hagar. Well, I'm not surprised there's a New Orleans legend here rounding out the set. It's Dr. John.
You know, there's a lot of legends that I went back and forth in choosing this. New Orleans has got such a great mix of music, but one of the legends, Ico Ico by Dr. John, I don't think it gets any better. And I can't even describe him. Describing Dr. John would be like me trying to describe to you what Mardi Gras is.
He looks like a beautiful dish.
Yeah, exactly.
If you had to describe Dr. John as a food, what would you describe him as?
You know, I had the pleasure of having him on Emerald Live, and I've had the pleasure of being in his company and seeing his work of art many times. And, you know, he's one of those guys that loves New Orleans and is very passionate not only about New Orleans and the people and the food, but he's very, very passionate about how he represents New Orleans from a music standpoint. And I'll tell you what, when he rocks, he rocks.
Find a link to the interview I did with Emeril about Eat the World on our website. That's it for this week's show. You can listen to any of the segments in this week's show at KCRW.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. That's
Abby Fentress-Swanson,
Laryl Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.